This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Warning, this episode contains details that some listeners may find disturbing. Tonight, join us for discussion about the various theories behind the strange death of George Reeves, the actor that brought Superman to life in the 1950s. Was it suicide like the authorities suggest, or was he murdered by his fiance or ex-girlfriend? This is a study of strange.
Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm Michael May, your host into all of things strange and weird and mysterious. And thank you for returning for part two of the strange death of Superman, the mystery revolving George Reeves and his suicide. And joining me again is Sean Anthony Davis. Thank you for being on, Sean.
I've been camped outside your house for all week, waiting for you to record the second half. Because you teased all these little morsels. I couldn't stay away. Yeah, no, I'm pumped. I'm excited for this.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you very much. And that was you outside my house.
That's really odd. Sorry, I try to be quiet, but...
So I'm going to review a couple of the things for people that may have either already forgotten or just need a refresher on the information. And if you haven't listened to part one, listen to part one so you can be caught up. So George Reeves, the actor who played Superman in The Adventures of Superman in the 50s, on June 16th, 1959, he went out to dinner with his fiance, Lenore Lemon, and came home later that night. The two of them had friends over. This is, again, the common story, as I said in part one, is that they had friends over: William Bliss, Robert Condon, Carol Van Ronkel. And George wanted to go to bed. He was upset. Everybody's making noise. He came down. They argue, blah, blah, blah. He goes back upstairs. Lenore mentions he's going to shoot himself. And then he shoots himself. And George Reeves, Superman, is dead at 45 years old. Very sad. There are a lot of strange things in this story. For one, the police weren't called for about 45 minutes. There's one bullet hole in the ceiling that was definitely the bullet that killed George Reeves, but there were two additional bullet holes in the ground. There's no fingerprints on the gun. There's no powder burns is what it's called on his head. There's weird stories that his brake fluid had been drained earlier when he got into a crash. His ex-girlfriend, Toni Mannix, she's married to a guy with a lot of connections to the underworld. She could have had him killed. Lenore and him may have been fighting over the wedding, or maybe they didn't want to get married or whatever, which was coming up in 3 days. That's one of the other main theories there. And I feel like I'm forgetting some of the odd, strange things.
Well, the one that for sure stuck in mind is that, well, you said it was a mystery that you were going to tell us the answer for, but that there was no fingerprints on the gun.
No fingerprints, yes. Yeah. So, yeah, there's just a lot of things that don't add up in this story. And one of the main theories is that Lenore killed him. Whether they got into an argument and she pulled the gun out or it was planned, I can't say, but that is one of the main theories. And like a lot of things I cover on this show, Sean, not everything with that common story I told you is true, which we can probably tell because it's a little bit weird.
Yeah.
And to be honest, we don't know what happened that night, but I think I've been able to piece together some things a little better than what most people hear. For one, the house guests, all these friends that were over, Robert Condon was a house guest. He was the only one that was kind of
staying.
He was staying there in the guest room. It's actually a relatively small house. I think it's only like 1,500 square feet. There's two bedrooms, and the guest room is kind of over the garage on the front side of the house, and that's where Robert Condon is staying. The other one of the other guests, Van Ronkel, Carol Van Ronkel, she was married. And it's really important to note, as I clarify things tonight, that her husband was not there. And there's a reason her husband was not there, and that's because she was having an affair with Robert Condon.
Okay. Oh, man, these free-willing 50s people.
Yep, exactly. Never changes. Yep. Oh, Hollywood. The other person that was there, William Bliss, stopped by. There are a lot of the stories, and I said this in part one, a lot of stories are that Carol and William came together. They were neighbors. They knock on the door because the porch light is on. That's not the case. William came later, and his wife was supposed to join him as well. They were invited by Carol. William Bliss did not know George, did not know Lamar Lemon.
Just like, oh, come over. It's going to be weird. Yeah. I don't know these. No, they're fine with it. It's one of those situations.
Well, it was one of those also, like the porch light being on.
Sure. Yeah.
I'll explain the light right now. So the story that Lenore tells, and I don't think she can fully be trusted. And also her main interview that I pulled this information from was decades later. It was in 1989. She has a long history of being an alcoholic.
1989,
so 30 years after. So, look, she's not going to remember everything correctly, but there are some really interesting details in her story and her interview. One is that she and George went to bed when they came home from dinner. They didn't hang out with people. They went straight to bed. She couldn't sleep. So she got out of bed and went downstairs, and the porch light was off. And out of habit, she turned it on. And that's the signal for people, as I mentioned in part one, like, hey, we're open for business. And this is somewhere she doesn't know exactly. That's the other thing to know about times. Everything's a guess. So even in like the accounts to the police, it's all like, roughly this.
Yeah.
So that's important to know too. But she says it's somewhere between like midnight and 1 o'clock. And she's a party animal, so she doesn't even think it's that late, but she couldn't sleep. Turns on the light. Soon after, William Bliss shows up. She doesn't really know him, but she's like, oh, Carol invited him. She invites him in for a drink to be hospitable. Carol and Robert Condon aren't in the living room hanging out. They're in the bedroom doing bedroom things. And so William Bliss is there, and that's when they hear a gunshot. And she claims George never came downstairs.
Well, I was going to say, because so she's claiming now that they did not see George. The other guests did not see George before. Okay.
And this seems to be corroborated by William Bliss when he was interviewed later.
Okay.
So George does not come downstairs and have the argument. And that's even in Hollywood Lane. They even have like Ben Affleck coming downstairs.
Yeah, I remember seeing this. Like, it's the guitar thing.
So he doesn't come downstairs. He shoots himself. The story about her, like almost premonition, sort of being, oh, he's going to shoot himself. I hear the drawer opening. See, he's getting the gun.
Yeah.
That didn't happen. What happened is they heard the gunshot, and she was like, I think, did he just shoot himself? Like that kind of moment.
Yeah.
She also pointed out, you can't hear the drawer open. Like the master bedroom it's not two full floors, but there's like two sets of staircases that go up the bedroom. You can't hear the freaking drawer.
This is one of those really old rusty metal filing cabinets.
Exactly. And what happened was the reason that the bullet went off, and we have to think about this in terms of her story. And she wasn't trying to one of the things I like about this is she wasn't trying to defend herself when she's doing this interview. She's just like going through her memory here's what kind of happened. So when you think about the police not being called for 45 minutes, one, some stories say it was 30 minutes. Some say, again, it just kind of depends on what you read. And it's not like they had a clock or stopwatch, adrenaline's pumping, they heard a gunshot. But definitely, look, it is
the
weird.
The point wasn't that it was right away. There was some time after.
There's some time. But it may not have been a full 45 minutes. But between the gunshot going off, some time passed before they went to check. And that's probably because you're just kind of weirded out. Like, was that? What?
Yeah.
So some time passes. Bill Bliss is the one that's like, I should go see what's going on up there. And he runs upstairs. He comes down. It's like George shot himself. He's dead. Lenore immediately starts thinking of her friend Carol and is like, well, if the police come, Carol's going to be outed. Her husband's going to find out she's having this affair. So she's trying to figure out how to get Carol and Robert like out of the house. That's like her main thing. Yeah. Like, oh shit, I got to get them out. And that was her thing. And also there's no Uber. I don't think Carol drove herself. So she's trying to figure out how to get Carol
Hollywood
out.
Hills in the middle of 1 a.m. or
exactly. 2 a.m. She has to call. She gets a friend of hers to come by and pick her up. And it takes time. So that's why, according to Lenore, that all this time went by before they called the cops. She claims, I don't know if I fully believe her. She claims that she never even went upstairs during this whole time before the police showed up. There's also these stories in like the common retelling of it all that when the police showed up, this whole group, Carol and Robert and Lenore and William Bliss, they were all hanging out in the living room drinking when the police showed up. I don't know if that's true or not, because there's so many discrepancies about like, no, it was just Lenore at the house when the police showed up. No, they were all there. Honestly, if they were all there, they probably were drinking. So I wouldn't necessarily take that as like.
It probably is a weird, it's one of those kind of weird heightened states where there's a giddiness to it, like a kind of morbid giddiness to it. I have one question. So and of all the retellings or accounts, both in interviews and whatever statements, is Lenore corroborated of not of being with other people when the gunshot goes off?
Yes. Okay. Well, she's only with, according to her, she's only with William Bliss.
That's right.
She's not with Carol and Robert.
The other, in the other bedroom.
But that is apparently very much corroborated and investigated thoroughly by the police. In fact, I'm going to send you something, Sean. I'm going to have you read some things. These are not all in order. I'm going to have you read some quotes from one of her interviews.
Oh, cool. Okay.
If I can copy accordingly, this will be fun. This will be good.
Still on. There we go. Got it.
Yep. Okay. So I'm going to have Sean here read some quotes, and I didn't format this, Sean. So I apologize. Okay. Whenever you don't see a quote, I'll just say whatever's like, I'll read next to interviewer and tee it up here. We'll figure it out as we go. There's no rules. There's no rules in a city. These are quotes from an interview Lenore Lemon did in 1989, which was only a year before she passed away. And she apparently, the first one you're going to hear is she apparently called her friend Polly to call to come pick up Condon. Go ahead, Sean.
So Polly puts on her clothes, takes Condon away. I said, well, that's one way. Now, I'm trying to think how I'm going to get Carol out of here, and I don't want her husband to know she's doing business with Mr. Condon. This is all going on. Well, I'm trying to get them out. Now, I called the police, and I just stay there. Police said, you got to get out of here. I said, but where do I go? But with Mrs. Van Ronkel to out there in the canyon to her house?
Yes, and this is the way she talks, by the way. She is very kind of flighty. Again, years of alcohol abuse.
I'm picturing the interview. She's chain smoking, probably has a glass of something.
I don't think she's smoking, but she does get a cocktail at the end of the interview, and she takes a sip, and I think she goes like, ooh la la, or something weird. Like it's amazing. So in another part of her interview, I'm going to read some interviewer questions. Mm-hmm. These are not necessarily in order because these were just notes I put in, but it'll be fun. So you were having a party.
I wasn't having a party. That dumbbell came by, Mr. Bliss or whatever his name was. No activity, no party.
There was activity going on in the other room?
They were friendly, I guess.
So this article is wrong then. It says Lenore was surprised by his agitation because he was angry people came over.
No, he was not.
You said, is this a work or a shoot? Wrestling jargon, kidding or serious?
Wait, is that a what or a what?
It also says suddenly Lenore supposedly looked at Condon. His expression was vacant and she said softly, he's going to shoot himself.
Condon was not there. Condon was in the guest room with Mrs. Van Ronkel.
So, yeah, so I apologize that that's kind of bouncing around there a little bit. But the point was, is that this interviewer was reading her newspaper article. And there's a lot of
contradictions to what,
yeah. So from, again, that quote-unquote common story and all the contradictions to it. So 45 minutes goes by. Again, thereabouts, 45 minutes before the cops are called, she tries to hustle everybody out. Depending on the source, her friends are either still at the house. Some of them are. Some of them are gone. I actually could not validate who was at the house besides her when the cops showed up. But we do have corroborating statements from these other witnesses, if you can call them that, from that night to police. Now, one of the things I loved about that interview she gave is that she didn't even know who Bliss was. Like, she forgot his name.
Yeah, that was intriguing. Where he's like, who? What was his name again?
Yeah. And that's because the interviewer had to tell her his name, and she did not really like him. Apparently, he was like, he talked a lot, and she didn't know who he was, and blah, blah, blah. So when he reminded her the name, she was like, oh, that's it. That's it.
Yeah.
Which, for a lot of people that think that there's a cover up, like, she killed Reeves and had her friends be like, tell everybody I wasn't up there. It wasn't me. It was a suicide. It's made it look like a suicide. It's kind of hard to get somebody you don't know and don't even know their name to go along with that for decades.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that kind of points to me that I don't think, in terms of the theory that Lenore killed him, that rings out to me as like, something to take note of.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a part of me that feels like, oh, there, I could see it not being a premeditated thing, but something circumstantially in the moment, her being kind of like circumstantially responsible for it. But so, like you said, there's no, as far as we know, there's no statement, there's no accounting of the story where she doesn't have an alibi when the gun goes off. And to me, that would, like, you know, if there was like one version of it where she was down with friends and there was another version where she was up in the room and that's when the gun goes off.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. But to clarify that, I do think, and please, listeners, if you know better, please email me at studyofstrange@gmail.com. But I do think William Bliss confirmed with the cops that he was with Lenore when the gun.
No, that's what I'm saying. That because because there is no version of the story where she's in the room when the gun goes off, that makes me feel like, yes, it would, I'm less inclined to believe she's involved, or at least not involved in the actual death. Yeah.
And I will mention as well, you don't see this come up very often, but apparently there was a lot of newspaper accounts at the time mentioned $5,000 being missing after he was killed.
Okay.
However, that the reason that never like became a thing or became a big part of the investigation is because it was actually $4,000. It wasn't five. And it was in like cashier's checks or traveler's checks or something like that. And Lenore actually had those and gave it over to the authorities and her lawyer. So a lot of people
wasn't actually missing. Okay.
Right. And it wasn't like, and it was stolen or anything. Like it all went through the proper channels after something like this. So let's talk real quick before I get to the Tony Mannix theory that she had him killed. Let's talk about suicide. We've already kind of talked about this, where like you never know the true state, mental state of somebody, even though he apparently was in a good mood and, you know, had potential work on the horizon. You and I know potential work on the horizon in Hollywood is not that that solid. And we just don't know what his mental makeup state was. We don't know if he was happy he was getting married to Lenore. Maybe they started to have a falling out and that was adding to this or exacerbating this sort of depression. We definitely know that he had money troubles. That was a big part of his life. And his mother even confirmed that. His mother, by the way, never thought he committed suicide, but she did confirm that he was having a lot of financial difficulties. And it doesn't help that he's a big drinker.
Yeah.
Big drinker. And so that adds to all this as well. And I'm going to talk now about the big tease from the last episode, the no fingerprints on the gun. Apparently, and this police investigated, this comes from the cops, it had recently been cleaned and oiled before the gunshot.
Okay.
And fingerprints don't stick.
There's still the oily residue.
There's still like an oily residue. And the powder burns, apparently they never tested for powder burns, but there is some, you know, there's documentaries and stuff about this. And some very smart person was like, well, if the gun was actually against the skin, the way the like burn happens doesn't it actually like burns the
powder off or something.
Something like that. Something that I didn't really fully understand, but someone very smart sold me on it.
So
there you go. And again, we already talked about the bullet being in the ceiling is weird, but he could have just been slouching.
Or the other thing too is just like, I mean, not to get too necessarily gratuitous, but bone matter, whatever is going on, like just a small little like redirection of the bullet trajectory and stuff, a minor degree in angle can, you know, launch it off into, you know, that. So that in and of itself, it seems very plausible to me.
Yes, me too. Me too. And so to me, the suicide thing is a very valid thing. A lot of people that worked with him, including, and I feel terrible because now I thought I'd remember the name, but the guy that played Jimmy Olsen in the series and some other actor friends, they don't believe a lot of the rumors that he was killed by someone else. Mm-hmm. They think he committed suicide. And those are people that knew him very well. There's this amazing clip I came across from one of those, a show that I would love to produce, but one of those like Hollywood mysteries from like the early 2000s, like anthology shows. And they interview the actor Jim Beaver from Supernatural, but one of my favorite actors. Mm-hmm. They interview him and he must not have been famous yet because they call him Jim Beaver, Hollywood historian. And he's talking about the case. Anyway, that's just a fun little thing I came across in researching. So let's dive into the final and the most fascinating theory, which is that Tony Mannix, his old flame, had him killed. And I mentioned in part one, she had been calling the house incessantly. There were stories that she had him followed. There's stories that she stole his dog. They were not in a good place, and she was not handling any of this well. And I'm sure it wasn't good on her that George and Lenore were about to get married as well. And her husband, Eddie Mannix, super tied in with the underworld and criminals and probably killers. All of that's conjecture, but it's very likely in his situation. And so she wasn't happy. She had the so-called motive that you look for in these kinds of cases. She also, I'll say this, people use this against Lenore's theory as well. When he died, most of his estate was left to Tony. Lenore fought that in court, I believe. But they weren't married yet and nothing had been changed in the will and all that kind of stuff. So there is one of these side theories to Tony's story being that she had invested all this financial.
And she wanted.
She wanted like, it back.
Recoup it back, yeah.
Yeah, like you're going to marry someone else. You don't love me anymore. Mm-hmm. I want all my shit back. Mm-hmm. And so that goes into this theory as well. But the truth is, let me back up a little bit. So the theory with this is that someone could have snuck in. And there are people that suspect when William Bliss showed up that it was actually a bit of a,
misdirect or something.
Misdirect. Mm-hmm. And someone could have snuck in the back door, the side door, gone upstairs and killed George. They knew he had the gun. Because it was given to him by Eddie Mannix. Tony probably knew where he kept it in the drawer. And so that's one of the theories. I don't believe this theory. I think a lot of people believe it. I think because motive is there and because they knew the right people to do it.
Yeah.
And again, I do think there is a little bit of validity to it. But to me, when you have to create these extra steps of like, William Bliss was a misdirect, and they had to go upstairs silently, and they had to know where the gun was, and they had to like...
Also, like, so, you know, sure, if you're a professional hitman or, whatever, who potentially does... That makes sense. Or you could just do it when no one's around and make it... Like, that seems like... why would you purposely kill someone when there are potential other people around that hear a gunshot, that are potential witnesses, and you're making it look like a suicide anyway, when you could have just made it look like a suicide on a night when no one was there? Like, I don't like that. Yeah. Like, it's not saying it can't have happened that way, but it just makes very little sense to me from that perspective. If I'm planning to kill someone, I'm not going to do it. 100%.
And that's what it comes down to. I talk about it endlessly and I probably annoy everybody, but the simple answer is most likely true. And you can say that a million different ways. There's sure, Occam's razor. Sherlock Holmes said it a different way, which I can't remember exactly right now.
Yeah, once you eliminate the impossible, the only remaining option, no matter how improbable, is true.
Yeah. But it comes into the same thing. And I feel like when you have to invent these little stories and you have to invent other little stories on top of stories to make something fit, it becomes, to me, less plausible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what happens with the Tony Mannix thing. I almost believe Lenore and him getting in a fight in some sort of drunken argument or shooting him. I almost believe that more than I do Tony Mannix.
That was kind of my thinking beforehand. And that's why I was asking specifically about her alibi in terms of when the gunshot goes off, because I could see very likely, well, I don't know, very likely.
Yeah.
I haven't been in an AS, thankfully, in a situation where someone's killed themselves. But I mean, like, if they get into an argument and he kind of threatens and she doesn't take him seriously, but then they kind of get in a squabble and something slips or goes wrong and she does technically pull the trigger or responsible, but it was never intended. And it wasn't like a I could see something like that being very plausible. But if she was not even in the room during that, I could see an alternate version where they're in bed and she leaves the porch light on. Don't leave the porch light. I don't want anyone coming over tonight. Just friends are going to come over. They get in a fight and then some friends do show up. And he's like, no, like there's already agitation. She's going to go down and he's drunk and depressed and whatever. And if you go down, I'm going to kill myself. If you go down, I'm going to take the gun out of the cabinet and kill myself. And she not taking him seriously. Like, again, I'm obviously this is all conjecture. I'm making this stuff up. But to me, that seems something that is very plausible. I don't know.
Yeah, it to me as well. And, you know, I lean more to the suicide thing, but to me, that is a plausible scenario. And I want to add a couple of interesting stories here. Years later, decades later, in terms of the Tony Mannix theory, it was a publicist. I forget his name right now, but there's a publicist that claimed that he overheard Tony admit that she had George killed.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
she also apparently told this to other people, even like a week after. Mm. But all the stories I heard sounds like she's doing like people want to blame me. So just I had him. That's the way it's kind of coming off to me.
Yeah.
The publicist all these decades later just so happened to be after everybody else was dead. And he claimed he could tell the story now because he wasn't threatened by Eddie Mannix or anything because all those people had died. But to me, it seems like someone trying to get some publicity themselves more than a thing of like, oh, I overheard her tell a priest that she killed him. And that's where a lot of stories, in fact, I think a lot of the stories about George coming downstairs and arguing, some of that comes from William Bliss's wife. She, again, decades later, claimed that she was also invited. So she was showing up, but she showed up late. And when she walked up to the house, she saw through the window George come downstairs and arguing in a robe with everybody before he went upstairs. And she was like, I don't want anything to do with this, and turned around and left. But it's like, why was it, you know, 20, 30 years later that you're telling this story? And why would you leave? Like, your husband's, you don't know any violence is about to happen. He's not holding a gun. Why would you turn around and walk away? So again, to me, that just doesn't feel real. Those stories, I don't believe those people. If they're telling the truth, I apologize to you, but it doesn't ring as true to me. So
No, I totally know what they mean. Just kind of this, like, people, I mean, and understandably so, not to be so condescending to, but because everyone, I think, probably has that. But there's an idea of like wanting to attach yourself to something significant and something like, I was there. I saw what happened. Even if you're fabricating or making things up, it attaches you to importance. It makes you feel like, okay, yeah, I was witness or as part of something that was, you know, important. So understandable, but not necessarily justifiable.
Yes. And so before we go, Sean, I want to take a few minutes because this story with George Reeves started the so-called Superman curse. I'm sure you've heard about this. So in your definition, what is the Superman curse?
I mean, to me, it's like, this is going to be a very silly comparison, but there's a baseball video game franchise called MLB The Show. Mm-hmm. And there's a cover athlete that comes out that's on it every year. Is it the Madden? I think it's the Madden curse. Anyway, it's the same idea. The Madden football video game franchise. And there's always a star athlete they choose who's going to be the cover athlete on.
Yeah.
And whoever that athlete for many years in a row, the next year that athlete gets injured is out for the rest of the season. Similar to that. Basically a curse of if you play Superman, something tragic happens to you, essentially, more or less.
Exactly. That's the idea. And look, I don't put stock in curses, no matter what, because I've been in a TV show where I had to talk about it and I had to believe in it a little bit just for the sake of the story. But I don't really believe in curses. But this it is an interesting one that's kind of spread. I think it probably started when we were like kids. Like,
well, I'm guessing the Christopher Reeve, I think, probably
yes
cemented in the current kind of like pop cultural modern zeitgeist kind of stuff, I think.
Exactly. But there are some other points to it. Mm-hmm. So I'll point these out real quick. Kirk Allen, who played Superman in the 1940s, had a similar situation of typecasting after that series ended. Or I shouldn't say series. I think it's just a few movies. But Kirk Allen couldn't get work anymore after the show. And he later died with Alzheimer's disease. I will quickly point out, he lived to be 88. So, that's a pretty long life.
Good for him.
Lee Quigley, who's the infant actor from Superman in 1978. Oh, a movie I'm vastly.
Yeah. Kal-El.
Kal-El died at 14.
Oh, wow.
And suffered from bullying and some other things. George Reeves, we just went over, committed suicide, may have been killed. Christopher Reeve, which sort of cemented this whole thing. I think most people are aware he was in horseback riding when he fell in and was paralyzed, right? And then he also died very young, which I was surprised to see today. He was only 50s. I thought he was older than that, but he was in his 50s when he passed away.
I mean, died in the 90s, right? Or was it even later than that? Was it the early
2000s? It was early 2000s, I think, he passed away. But his accident was in 1995.
Yeah, okay.
There's other alleged victims, which include Marlon Brando, because not himself personally, but he went through a lot of turmoil with relatives and kids and some other things, which I don't remember all the details of, but some nasty things happened. Margot Kidder, who played Lois Lane in the Big franchise, she had a lot of mental issues and got into some car accidents. She also completely writes off the Superman curse as being ridiculous. Richard Pryor tried to commit suicide, lit himself on fire. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of even Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who created Superman. They spent decades fighting for more rights and more money and stuff, and weren't treated well after creating Superman. So that's you know what? You probably could add Allison Mack, who played Chloe Sullivan in Smallville.
I guess that's a curse.
Sex trafficker. So maybe you can put that in there. But I will say there's a lot of people that have not had anything crazy.
I was going to say Henry Cavill. Let's see. Yep. I mean, he dropped out of The Witcher. Dean Cain's probably.
Here, I have
Ripley's, believe it or not. Brandon Routh.
Yeah. I've met Brandon before. He's a super sweet guy.
Yeah, he seems super. He hasn't been in anything. I don't know if he's, I assume he's still acting.
He's still around. I think he's been, I see him in some like Hallmark movies every Christmas because my wife watches all those. Tom Welling, I think Tom Welling's doing well. He was in Smallville. Okay. So like there's plenty of things to say, you know, there's no curse, but I just thought that would be fun to kind of go over.
I mean, some of that stuff, some of those I definitely did not know, but some of them, and just vaguely aware of that idea of the curse. I think it's just kind of speaks to the idea of what maybe even is so kind of intriguing about the George Reeves things, whether he killed himself or not. And I tend to believe that it was a suicide. There's something about the idea of Superman, right? Like, I know it, like, it's almost like a Greek tragedy, right? If it wasn't real life, it would come across as phony and cheesy. Oh, the guy who plays Superman is killed by a bullet, right? Like, it's so like kind of cliche, but because it is real, it kind of almost speaks to more of the human element of it. It was like, despite playing Superman on TV, he still suffers from depression. You still can't get over heartbreak or money problems, and those things bog you down, and sometimes there's nothing
Absolutely. Yeah, it's tough. It's a tough life. And also you never know what other people are going through. You never do, even people close to you. And I think that's why you have to treat people well, treat people with respect, because you never know what someone else is going through. And if George Reeves did in fact commit suicide, which I believe, he was going through a lot, and he was probably going through more than we realized, and maybe even he realized too. You know, he may not have had a grasp on everything going on,
especially at that time and stuff. I mean, you mentioned he joined the army. He didn't actually see any combat, so I don't think there was any case of PTSD or anything like that. But it also does kind of speak to how it's a little bit, more tragic. From by all accounts, he seemed to be like a good-natured guy, not to break people down into binaries, but someone who's like generally, a well-to-do guy who treated people kindly, always wanted the best for people, probably saw himself worse than others saw him, you know, that kind of thing. As suicide, people don't commit suicide, don't fall into easy patterns. Don't fall into an easy type of we could just see, that person's going to commit suicide. Obviously, that's not how it works. And people are way more complicated than that.
So. They are. And I will say, whether you believe her and trust her or not, and I don't, as much as I thought she gave a lot of interesting evidence to me, I still don't believe everything she said just because of her own memory. And she may be covering up some stuff. But Lenore Lemon's account of everything, she obviously claims that he committed suicide. And when she's asked why he did it, she primarily talks about money and not being able to get a role. And I think it's really important. Look, I'm an actor. I'm never going to stop trying to be an actor my whole life. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that I have other creative pursuits like podcasting and filmmaking and stuff. But being told you can't act anymore, devastating. And even if it could, financial, yes, that's a hardship. He may have been more impacted by, sure, I can make some money here or there doing various things, but I'm literally being told I can't act. Yeah. I can't play other roles. And that is what's the point? What's the point? And that was a thought I had after reading all of that,
Yeah. And I mean, for those of us who have had opportunities to know what it's like to be drunk, that sentence makes sense. I could understand how a certain mental spiral, even in a weird, in a time like he was in bed, he had that he would not be thinking about money problems at that moment and decide to kill himself. No, not necessarily in that way, but it could be set up a conversation that spurs it. And then this kind of mental spiral while you have people downstairs that you're going around, you start thinking is this just what I'm looking forward to? And I just got to go out and pretend to put on this pony show of being Superman the whole rest of my life. And what am I doing? In that kind of mental state is potentially a dangerous combination. So,
indeed. Well, thank you, Sean, for taking the time to do these stories and these couple of episodes about George Reeves. I have, you know this, but I have a fascination with Hollywood and Hollywood history.
Hollywood, LA, transplant. I'm from San Diego, so I've always been LA and Hollywood adjacent. Yeah. Not until my adult did I actually move to LA and got to live the dream. But it's always been fascinating. I love movies set in LA. I'm a sucker for that stuff. And I love LA noir kind of stuff. Some of my favorite movies are the big LA crime. I call it the trilogy. I guess this is probably most people think, but Chinatown, all about the water rights and I. LA Noir, all about the news and policing and film industry. And mentioned previously or in the previous episode, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? I do think that's LA Noir, in the best sense. And it's all about the transportation system in LA. So all that stuff. And this fits right in. It totally does. So
it does. It does. You mentioned three of my favorite films. And Chinatown's in my top five, by the way. I think Chinatown is a perfect movie.
Oh, all-time classic.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, thank you so much for doing this. And we will see you soon. Oh, is there anything you want to push, promote, or anything?
Oh, sure. Well, as mentioned, there may be a project coming out, maybe sometime later this year, in the future, whatever, that I worked with Michael on. So look forward to that. I'm very excited for that. A music video I worked on, AD'd on, just actually came out. So everyone, that's probably on YouTube. By the band Dave and I, BKOA. Go look it up online. It's a cool little music video. Otherwise, Naughty Dog, go watch Last of Us. Go play Last of Us. And one last little plug. Yeah. If anyone's going to be in Comic-Con this year, Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con 2024, come up to the games booth. I will be there. I designed a board game with a friend and my brother, and we are going to be demoing our board game. So very nerdy stuff. But if anyone happens to be at Comic-Con, come check out our board game. And we're going to launch the Kickstarter later this year to get it funded.
Do you have a name?
It's called Extraction. It's a sci-fi co-op game. You're a bunch of space prisoners on a ship attacked by aliens, and you're the last hope of survival for the crew. So you got to be the badasses, break out of prison, rescue survivors while you're killing aliens, and get off the ship before it explodes.
Awesome. That's so cool. I'm so excited.
Anyways, so there you go. Check that stuff out.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, and I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. It was a blast.
Thank you for listening to A Study of Strange. And again, a special thank you to Sean Anthony Davis. Take a quick second before you go, hit that subscribe button, rate and review wherever you watch. That's a great way to have more people be able to find our show. Additionally, you can support the show by subscribing to our Substack, which you can find through our website, astudyofstrange.com. There's a bunch of additional content, exclusive content. I'm also planning to put out a bunch of articles about all wonderful sorts of strange mysteries over the summer on the Substack, because I'm not going to be able to record as much, so I'm going to fill that as much as I can. Thank you all again for listening. Good night.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.